Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the proposed $25 billion settlement of the mortgage mess expected at any moment and whether the Obama administration will step up in a showdown with the banks. Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect, joins us to discuss this crucial election year issue for the Obama administration, given that one in four American households are underwater, and so far the banks, who have committed massive and systemic fraud, have not been held to account. Then we will look into the deepening humanitarian tragedy in Syria, where, since the Russian and Chinese veto in the United Nations, the Assad regime has rained down shells, rockets, and mortars on civilian populations, especially in the restive city of Homs. An important member of the Syrian opposition, Radwan Ziadeh, joins us to describe how the regime is taking advantage of the window provided by the Russian veto to try to eliminate the lightly armed opposition fighters and the civilian population they are defending. Then finally, we'll examine the president's freezing of all Iranian government assets held or traded in the United States and his recent answers on NBC, where he was asked if Israel could launch a preemptive strike on Iran. The president said, "I don't think Israel has made a decision on what they need to do." But when asked the direct question whether Washington would be consulted first about an Israeli strike, the president declined to answer, saying only that the U.S. and Israel have closer military and intelligence consultation than they've ever had. The former senior director of Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council, Flint Leverett, joins us to discuss mixed signals from the White House as the screws turn on Iran. I'm now joined by Robert Kuttner, who is the co-founder and co-editor of the American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. Robert Kuttner is the author of 8 books, including the latest, A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street Power, and the Struggle to Control our Economic Future. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Showdown for the Banks, Showtime for Obama. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Kuttner.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
And the $25 billion settlement that we're expecting to hear about at any moment, that's limited to the fraud connected to the fake robo-signing deals, right? It's not...
Yes, and it looks like we're not going to hear about it at any moment because several of the key attorney generals, including Kamala Harris, are not signing off on it yet because the draft is too soft on the banks.
But I guess the theory is, and you've written about this in the Huffington Post, is that this, at this point, is still leverage over the broader issues. This is a drop in the bucket, $25 billion, right, in terms of the massive and systemic fraud that we're talking about.
Well, it's a drop in the bucket in two senses. First of all, it's not even $25 billion because a lot of these mortgages have already been written down, so the real cash cost to the bank is going to be more like $5 billion. And secondly, the question is whether by signing this deal, the banks get any release from broader liability. And the attorneys general who have held out, which include some of the most important ones, Harris from California, Eric Schneiderman from New York, Bo Biden from Delaware, where a lot of these trusts are incorporated, Martha Coakley from New York, Masto from Nevada, where you got the highest foreclosure rate. A lot of these AGs are saying, even though, you know, we'd love to liberate some of this money to get some relief for the people who were suffering in our states, we're not going to sign on to this deal if it ties our hands in terms of further civil suits or further criminal prosecution. And the deal seems to be stuck at this point on that question. I mean, the administration, the banks, had set a deadline of close of business today, and the AG said, sorry, we're not going to sign anything until you resolve this stuff. And Schneiderman, you know, filed this huge suit on Friday against three of the biggest banks for fraud in some of the same areas that are supposedly covered by this deal. And so that was Schneiderman's way of saying, look, even if we do this deal, I am not going to tie my hands in terms of other cases. So this deal may go up in smoke.
But at this point, Robert Kuttner, the $25 billion doesn't seem like very much, given that one in four U.S. households are underwater and millions of Americans have already been evicted from their homes. Something like, what is it, 11 million?
Yeah, if you calculate the difference between the value of homes and the mortgages on those homes, that is the how far underwater these underwater homeowners are, it's about $750 billion. And this was a housing bubble that was caused by the fraudulent practices of the banks. So what's that? $25 billion on 750, that's about 3%. And so some of the tougher state AGs, like Schneiderman, like Harris, are hoping that this deal would be a down payment on a much bigger deal. And presumably, they could leverage a lot more money out of the banks in the form of fines by proceeding with continued investigations and suits. And so the sticking point in this deal is whether the attorney generals agree to back off in exchange for what is really a fairly paltry amount of money.
So just let's get this straight, though, Robert Kuttner, because it seems appalling to me that millions of Americans have already lost their homes, millions more are underwater, and then millions more are treading water, and the banks have already been bailed out by the taxpayers, and
yep.
These people still haven't seen any relief, and the relief offered so far is a paltry $25
billion. Yeah, and it's not even a real $25 billion, and some of that would not even come from the banks. It would come from the people who have bought the securitized loans, a lot of which are pension funds. So, I mean, the pension funds have been ripped off by the banks, and some of the players want the pension funds to eat some of this loss. So, you know, as a down payment on a bigger deal, if it doesn't tie the hands of the administration or the attorneys general in terms of further investigations and further prosecutions, it's a deal worth having. But it may be a bridge too far in the sense that the banks were hoping that in exchange for this deal, they would not just get a cleanup of the mess as far as the robo-signing problem is concerned, but would get immunity from prosecution on the much bigger set of issues, and the state AGs don't appear to be willing to sign on to that deal. So we may or may not see a deal, and I think if we do, it's going to be a deal that allows the attorneys general to pursue further litigation, because the attorneys general who've been balking so far are pretty tough. They're pretty progressive. They're pretty much committed to the public interest, and I just can't imagine them going along with a deal that would say, "So, okay, banks, you've got to get out of jail free card, and you're not going to have to pay any more money. You're not going to face any more prosecution." I just can't imagine that deal going down.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was previously chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee and has an article in the Huffington Post, Showdown for the Banks, Showtime for Obama. Now, the Schneiderman suit blocks the ability of the banks to foreclose on more than the 70 million properties held in the names of MERS. This is the electronic system that the banks use to evade county recording fees. Apparently, they saved $2 billion in doing so, but it's created this massive vacuum that didn't it result in the robo-signing, where they fraudulently, retroactively tried to find some paperwork on these packaged mortgage securities?
Well, there's two separate parts to this. One is that they used people. They weren't robots. They were people. But the people attested to the supposed fact that these trust agreements contained mortgages that had been properly registered, and in fact they weren't properly registered. So it's the narrow issue of the robo-signing fraud that is the subject of this proposed $25 billion deal. But Schneiderman went much further than that. I mean, in his litigation, he says, first of all, that because a lot of the trust documents that hold these securities don't actually have the mortgages in them that they claim to. And because a lot of the mortgages that should have been recorded with state or county or city recorders of deeds were not properly recorded, that the banks don't have the right to foreclose if somebody falls behind in their payments. Now, that's very good for the consumer and the homeowner. It's a total disaster for the banks because it gums up the machinery of foreclosure even more than it's already gummed up. So from the bank's point of view, with one hand, the attorneys general and the federal government is proposing this deal to clean up this very narrow one area involving so-called robo-signing. But with the other hand, Schneiderman is launching much broader litigation against the banks. So the banks are saying, wait a minute, is this a deal that's good for us or not? And on the other hand, Schneiderman is saying, I'm not signing on to any deal that precludes my ability to continue prosecuting. So I think based on the different interests of the banks on the one hand, Schneiderman on the other hand, I don't know if this deal is going to go down.
But I'm trying to get a sense here from you, Robert Kuttner, about whether the $70 million in properties held in the name of MERS, this electronic system that the banks used, is that in the pipeline? Is that what you're saying, that there are 70 million more properties that could be foreclosed upon that are in the pipeline?
No, I'm saying the opposite. There are 70 million homes that should have been properly, when the sale is made and the mortgage is taken out, that's supposed to be recorded with the local recorder of deeds. The banks, when they started securitizing subprime mortgages, they set up this electronic database controlled by the banks called MERS that does an end run around the state laws that require the mortgage to be recorded. And Schneiderman is saying to the banks, you guys broke the law when you set this thing up and used it as a way of doing an end run around the proper title recording system. And as a consequence of that, you don't have a legal lien against the property if the person forecloses, and so you don't have the right to foreclose. And furthermore, we're going to sue you for damages because you evaded at least a couple of billion dollars in fees and taxes when you fail to record these transfers properly.
So we're talking about a $70 million properties? That's a huge amount of properties.
Well, we're talking, you see, once they set up MERS, it became standard operating procedure not to do the traditional recording of transfer of ownership one property at a time, but to use MERS as if it had some kind of legal standing. And Schneiderman suit says, sorry, guys, MERS doesn't have any legal standing, and you broke the law when you set it up. So it completely, throws a monkey wrench into the whole system that the banks thought they could use to transfer title and to proceed with foreclosures. And I think the reason that the banks wanted this settlement is that all over the country, homeowners are resisting being foreclosed upon, and a lot of judges are siding with homeowners. So the banks thought that by, paying $25 billion, at least they would get this mess cleaned up. Now it looks like whether or not they pay the $25 billion, they're going to face even more serious litigation by attorneys general like Schneiderman. And Schneiderman's been very clear about this. His goal is to blow up MERS. And the New York litigation is kind of a template for attorneys general in other states to go after MERS. So this is quite a mess.
Well, but he's clearly right, though, isn't he? That the due process, if you will, was not done, and that there is ambiguity, and that people are losing their homes. And most of these people have the ability to service some of their mortgages, mortgage payments, but a lot of them were full of small print and tricks, etc.
Yeah.
I don't understand why the banks aren't willing to settle for a compromise, and why they would basically be so hardline about this thing, given the enormous amount of foreclosed properties already on their books?
Well, because they don't want their balance sheets to take a bigger hit. They don't want to pay out more money, and you have to hope that Schneiderman and the new federal task force will just keep going after the banks so that mortgage holders get a lot more principal relief, a lot more write-down. I mean, the right way to do this is to have a strategy where somebody who has a house, let's say, that is worth $400,000 and has a mortgage of $600,000, you reduce the $600,000 mortgage to the current value of the house. And that way, the homeowner gets to stay in the house, and the bank doesn't foreclose, and you get some stability in the housing market. But the banks have been unwilling to do that because they don't want to take that big a loss. Now, the fact is, they've taken that loss already because the value of the mortgage is not what they claim it is if they were to try and sell it. But they don't want to write it down on their books because if they recognize it as an accounting loss, then they got to put up more capital to offset the loss, and they don't want to do that.
Well, how does this relate, though, to President Obama? Because and this election year, my understanding, Robert Kuttner, is that there's a great deal of distress out there. You know, Romney's talking about he doesn't care about the poor and he doesn't care about the rich, and he only cares about the middle class. And clearly the middle class are in distress, if indeed we've exaggerated the very existence of the middle class. You would think that there would be probably no election issue that is more where the rubber meets the road than a quarter of all homeowners being underwater, and millions more are already out in the street or about to go out in the street. You would think that he'd be absolutely on their side and making an issue out of this.
Well, this is what he tried to do in the State of the Union address, and it's a pretty good speech, I thought. The question is whether, you know, the policy goes along with the speech, and in fairness to Obama, I mean, the proposal that he made for to make it easier for underwater homeowners to refinance, that would require legislation. I think where you can fault Obama is that he has allowed Geithner to protect the banks, and that in turn sent a signal to Holder, the Attorney General, not to really prosecute these guys. And I think Geithner's original sin was to protect the banks rather than to break them up and get real relief for homeowners. Now it's kind of difficult 3 years in for Obama to do a 180 and say, you know, the banks really are the bad guys and we ought to get a lot more money out of them. So you have to hope that this task force and that the state AGs will put a lot more pressure on the banks with threats of criminal prosecution to squeeze a lot more mortgage relief out of them.
And Schneiderman's got two hats, right? He's also been, Obama has appointed him to this new federal task force.
That's
on criminal.
Right. And, it's very tricky, the double role that Schneiderman is playing. I mean, on the one hand, he's working with Obama, but on the other hand, he's being quite a tough prosecutor. And if he was going to let himself be rolled by either this settlement process or by some of the more cautious people in the administration, he would not have filed this lawsuit last week. And so I think filing this very tough lawsuit was his way of saying, you know, if you think I'm just going to be window dressing for a sweetheart deal, you've picked the wrong guy.
Well, just in closing, Robert Kuttner, it does seem strange in an election year that Obama can't take credit for coming to the rescue of the middle class and the American dream, and he's leaving it to a state attorney general, albeit a good one.
He is trying to represent that this task force represents a new toughness against the banks. It's not just the state attorney general, but it's him. And we'll have to see how that plays out.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Kuttner, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone and was a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. He's the author of 8 books, including his latest, A Presidency in Peril, The Insider Story of Obama's Promise, Wall Street Power, and The Struggle to Control Our Economic Future. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Showdown for the Banks, Showtime for Obama. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment.
All that diamond dust, blowing up your hopes, flamboyant obstacles. Oh, deals made too cold, ideas in decline. Rise of the lost, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Hey, here we stand. Slave to networks, master plans. Swag's the brand, open a can. Chains off still, yeah, I never ran. But who do you think you are?
الشعب السوري ما بينزل بيان رقم واحد اكيد هيك ما حنضل بيان رقم واحد من حرام بلشت البشاير بيان رقم واحد للشعب السوري ساير.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Radwan Ziadeh, the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. He's also a visiting scholar at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University and a visiting fellow at Chatham House, the Royal Institute for International Affairs in London. He also co-founded and directed the Syrian Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C., and previously was the editor-in-chief of Tiarat magazine and secretary of the Syrian Organization for Transparency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Radwan Ziadeh.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly things have escalated since the Russian and Chinese veto of the Arab League and the Western attempts to bring an end to the killing in Syria. It looks as though the veto by the Russians and the Chinese have given this Assad regime an excuse to start ramping up the killing. They've been shelling the city of Homs indiscriminately, which of course flies in the face of Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov's claim that Moscow supported peaceful dialogue in Syria.
I think that the Russian and Chinese veto give the Assad regime the green light to do the huge assault to the Homs, Zebedani, Daraya, and other cities in Syria. This is cannot be actually done without having the green light from the Russians, despite of the visit, the announcement of the visit of Mr. Lavrov to Damascus, which we don't expect or anticipated anything will come out from this visit, because the Russians have been supportive of the Assad regime, supportive actually all the operations how the Assad regime has been doing in the last 11 months. Now the question, what the international community should do to protect the civilians in Syria and stop the killings by the Assad regime. I think now the time for the international community to take the actions and to establish the friends, the coalition of friends of Syria. This coalition should be support and help the Syrians by the humanitarian aid, economically and politically, and to take the necessary actions in the future, merely to intervene in Syria to protect the civilians and stop the killings of the civilians.
Well, Radwan Ziadeh, my understanding from BBC reports, and as you know, the Syrian government has not allowed outside journalists in, but the reports that are coming in suggested that many, many civilians are being killed, that mortar shells, rockets, and artillery are just raining down on the city of Homs, and the houses there don't have any basements.
So yeah, it's because there is many structures inside the city to protect the civilians, like the city in Homs and Rustan and Dara. This is why, actually, they've been shelling the cities by rocks. They cannot get inside the cities, because the center of the city is almost actually out of the control of the Assad regime. This is why they're launching by rockets and missiles against the civilians. And also they've been actually dependent on the helicopters without their pilots, which gets from Iran, to get actually...
Could you repeat that? I'm sorry, I missed that. The helicopters have something, some equipment they got from Iran?
Yes, we got information today actually from Homs, where actually they said that there was some helicopters without pilots making surveys for the cities, and they put some directions for some areas like the hospital, the field clinics, And that actually transferred this information to the Syrian army, who's been actually attacked and killed by the rockets and the missiles. It's clear that Iran been actually helping and backing the Assad regime by the equipment and by all the necessary money, and sometimes in Homs itself there is 29 Iranian who are actually members in the revolutionary guard has been actually detained by the Free Syrian Army. It's clear that Iran has involved in the killings of the Syrian people, and this is why should be consequences about the relationship between the Syria and Iran.
So the Iranians are in the helicopters. They're helping the Syrian army spot hospitals where the Syrian army are targeting. Because my understanding is that if you if you're wounded, you try and seek treatment, you're immediately arrested or killed on the spot. And anybody carrying medical equipment or first aid equipment is automatically shot as well. Is that true?
Exactly. And this is why what's happened today, as example, in the two cities in Homs and Daraya, where actually the army started attacking the hospital, because if you are wounded, you have no chance to live, because being targeted inside the hospitals or anyway, this is why no one actually been transferred the injured people to the hospitals. They putting them in field clinics, in field hospitals, but even that when the Assad regime, they know where the location of those hospitals has been attacked and gone shelled by the Assad militias and Shabiha, for the Assad thugs.
And the Shabiha are the sort of secret police that operate at night, so-called ghosts. So the Syrian regime is looking for these impromptu field hospitals, which is the only places that are available to treat the wounded, whether they're fighters or civilians, presumably, because nobody can get treatment in a hospital. We spoke some time ago, Radwan Ziyadeh, and I know that you're a member of the Syrian opposition, and you were one of the first people I spoke to who felt that a civil war was all but inevitable. Give me a sense of where things stand in that regard. This is at this moment, this is the bloodiest moment in this 11th month long uprising.
I think the Assad regime is pushing the country to go in the way of the civil war, because this is the only way for the Assad regime to survive, to say to the Syrians, we have only alternative. You have to accept the tyranny of the Assad, or you will go in the civil war. But at the same time, you have a full conscience of the Syrian people about the strategy of the Assad regime, avoiding any kind of civil war by refusing actually to attack Alawite civilians or others who are actually being avoided to be part of the Assad regime. I mean, the situation, of course, as the killings is continue, it's much more difficult, of course, to hold and to control things in Syria because the type of the crimes was being carried out by the Assad militias and the Assad Shabiha is very, very horrible, and that's where the situation is really grave and open to the all options.
So are you saying, Radwan Ziyadeh, that the Assad regime is provoking the opposition by their brutality and that they want a civil war?
Exactly, because they've been actually torturing children and raping women and then send the dead bodies to the families to send a message to the whole public that we'll do the same if you continue your struggle and your demonstrations against the Assad regime. The regime is insisting and provoking the civil war as the only options for the Assad right now. The Assad has lost all the legitimacy and all the support from the Assad population, and this is why the only now strategy still has, of course, to commit more, to murder more people and to commit more crimes because he thinks that still the security solution will be able to quell the protest and end the uprising.
But this logic surely applies to the other side too, doesn't it, Radwan Ziyadeh, to the Free Syrian Army and the people who initially tried peaceful protest and then were fired upon. Given what happened at the United Nations, that the Arab League and the Western countries could not get Russia and China to agree to do anything, and Russia, of course, is selling arms to Assad as we speak, what other alternatives are there for the Syrian opposition who are not getting any help from anybody, whereas Assad is getting military equipment from Russia and diplomatic cover from China? What alternative do the Syrian opposition have but to increase armed struggle?
This is the only alternative, is to support the Free Syrian Army. We don't have other options to protect the civilians in Syria. You cannot actually wait and see that the Assad militia is killing your father, your brother, your sister, and you are just waiting to be killed at any time. This is now the only way to protect the civilians, to support and to back the Free Syrian Army. Those brave soldiers and officers who refuse to open the fire on their fellow Syrians and start attacking and protecting the civilians, protecting the protest. They hold the highest responsibility by actually attacking the different areas, areas by the Assad regime. Now the question, because we are not getting any help or support, even that's from the Security Council, from the United Nations, it's clear that the Free Syrian Army became and rise as the only heroes in the eyes of the Syrians, because they are protecting the civilians and not allowing for the Assad regime to continue the assault on different cities in Syria.
But again, I'm speaking with Radwan Ziyadeh, the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. He's a visiting scholar at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University and a visiting fellow at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. He co-founded and directed the Syrian Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C., and previously was the editor-in-chief of Tiarat magazine and secretary of the Syrian Organization for Transparency, and he's now working with the Syrian opposition. But what I am trying to understand from what you're telling us, Radwan, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that what is happening now, that the Russians and the Chinese have given the Assad regime cover, that the Assad regime is moving as quickly and as brutally as it can to defeat the Free Syrian Army now, because there's a window of opportunity and nobody is helping the Free Syrian Army. Is that right?
Exactly.
And how long can the Free Syrian Army hold on against a heavily armed modern military? And all they've got,
because
my understanding is
they can't have Assad army.
Right.
We don't have a national army. All being actually officers and soldiers has been defected and formed different groups under the umbrella of the Free Syrian Army. And they have, of course, they have the will and they have the support from the Syrian people, and they have support from the Syrian National Council, the main opposition group, but they don't have the equipment and, of course, to fight the Assad militias. This is why now the only way actually for that to get the help and support for the Free Syrian Army from the Arab countries or from the Arabian or the Americans, because this is the only way actually. If the international community is not willing to intervene to help the Syrians, this is why they have to support the Free Syrian Army.
But again, I'm speaking with Radwan Ziadeh, the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. He's a visiting scholar at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University and a visiting fellow at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. He co-founded and directed the Syrian Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C., and previously was the editor-in-chief of Tiarat magazine and secretary of the Syrian Organization for Transparency, and he's now working with the Syrian opposition. And the rebellion itself, you mentioned a lot of officers have defected, and I believe that the bloodshed in Homs was precipitated by a fairly large group of Syrian soldiers and officers who are at a roadblock and who defected to the opposition en masse, and that's led to this retaliation, which has now escalated since the UN-Russian-Chinese veto of a draft resolution. My understanding is that most of the support for the opposition is largely amongst the working class people, the less affluent. And to what extent is this a people's revolution?
Could you repeat your question?
I said, to what extent, given that my understanding is that most of the support for the Syrian opposition comes from the working people, as opposed to the elite who have been taken care of by the regime. Is this a people's revolution?
No, this is not it's not fact anymore. Now the support, the Syrian opposition being actually supported by all actually different classes in Syria, the business elite, because even that, until now, you cannot name none of the businessmen or in the communities like in Damascus or in Aleppo. They are still actually support the Assad regime or involved of one of the activities of the Assad regime. Now, the Syrian, the uprising being involved by all the working class and the business elite in different cities in Syria. But of course, there is of course a large number of people still afraid about what's next after the fall of the Assad regime. The Assad regime held the power more than 42 years. This is why it became a question for every Syrian who's next and how the transition will be. It of course will be difficult because we are under dictatorship more than 42 years. It's not an easy to build a strong and functional democracy. But we do believe right now all the Syrians, they have the same feeling that the Assad regime became the main source of the instability in the country. And this is why the best way to have to get out of the regime to retrain the stability and the democracy in the country.
Well, just in closing, Radwan Ziadeh, if there is no alternative but to arm the Syrian opposition and to help the Syrian opposition at this moment where the Assad regime have got political cover from the Russians and Chinese and they're doing everything they can to defeat the Free Syrian Army, I understand that some arms and equipment are coming through Turkey. Who is helping? Is there any evidence of any large-scale support, or will this...
No, there is no. We did not get any support from Turkey. Some officers in the Free Syrian Army, they're based in Antakya and Turkey, in Hatay province, but that doesn't mean that they get any support from Turkey. And this is one of the issues, because without support, the Assad regime will continue the killings in the large scale. If the international community is not willing to intervene to support the civilians, they have to support actually the rebels, because by arming them, because this isn't the only way. We tried all the political solutions, but it failed by the Assad regime. The only thing that the Assad regime can understand is by using force to stop the force. The force has been used by the Assad militia.
As far as I know, the only weaponry that the opposition have are the AK-47s and the light arms that the soldiers defect with. Is there any covert arming that's going on? Because obviously it's going to be difficult to get the Western countries to want to openly send arms in, but I imagine that there are all kinds of ways to bring in armaments under the table, as it were. What's your sense? Should there be an open call for arming the opposition, or should this be done covertly?
If you see an army, they only depends about on the guns they have when they are defeated. And I told you before that I said because a large number of people have been defected, the Assad militia, they cannot get in the city, and they are actually depending on the shelling the city and killing the civilians along with the all who defected. And this is why a large number of victims every day of the civilians. Today more than 100, yesterday 230, and the day before 300. And the number is increasing. And this is why the only way to protect now the Syrian people by taking actions from the international community and supporting the opposition and arming the Free Syrian Army to organize themselves and to start to liberate the country from different areas.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Radwan Ziyadeh. Again, I've been speaking with Radwan Ziyadeh. He's the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. He's also a visiting scholar at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University and a visiting fellow at Chatham House, the Royal Institute for International Affairs in London. He also co-founded and directed the Syrian Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C., and previously was the editor-in-chief of Tehrat magazine and secretary of the Syrian Organization for Transparency. He's now an important member of the Syrian opposition. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the latest round of sanctions against Iran.
پر به سوی تو هر کجا پا می نهم سر فرود آرم قبله گاه من شده خاک کوی
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Flint Leverett, who is a professor of international affairs at Penn State University and directs the Iran Project at the New America Foundation, where he's also a senior research fellow. From 1992 to 2003, he served as senior director for Middle East affairs at the National Security Council. He also served on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff and as a senior CIA analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about the Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He's the author of Dealing with Tehran, Assessing U.S. Diplomatic Options Towards Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Flint Leverett.
Good to be back with you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And we just to finish up on, I had a member of the Syrian opposition on a minute ago. As you know, the United States embassy has been closed in Damascus. The diplomats have been evacuated. The opposition figures from Syria said that in the city of Homs is under siege and being bombarded, and that Syrians are using Iranian drones, helicopter drones, and that the Free Syrian Army have captured 27 Revolutionary Guard Corps members of Iran that are helping the Assad regime. Do you have any further information on that?
No. And, you know, I think it would be very interesting to see if the Free Syrian Army actually produces any of these Revolutionary Guard officers that they've allegedly captured. You know, there's been this story for many months that the Revolutionary Guard is helping the Syrians, advising them on their response to the, you know, various demonstrations, disturbances, so forth. What I find really, what just doesn't add up for me on that, is that the Syrians are pursuing you know, a security response to the demonstrations that is very, very different from anything that the Revolutionary Guard has ever done, you know, in 2009 or at any other point. You know, the Syrians are sending regular military units, armored units with tanks, armored personnel carriers, and so forth, into urban areas. This is something that the Revolutionary Guard has never done, has no experience with. So if the Revolutionary Guard are, you know, if they're advising the Syrians, you know, they're, you know, the Syrians are doing something that the Revolutionary Guard has never itself done. So I find the stories about the, you know, Syrian support, Revolutionary Guard support for what the Syrians are doing on the ground, I just, you know, it, at least with the evidence that's been put on the table so far, it just doesn't really add up for me.
Well, let's turn to, there's quite a lot to talk about vis-a-vis Iran, with the president announcing that he's freezing Iranian government assets, all Iranian government assets held or traded in the U.S. He also was on NBC on Sunday, where he was asked if Israel could launch a preemptive strike on Iran. The president said, "I don't think Israel has made a decision on what they need to do." But when he was asked the direct question whether Washington would be consulted before an Israeli strike, the president declined to answer, saying only that the United States and Israel have closer military and intelligence consultation than they've ever had. But a couple of days before, the Secretary of Defense Panetta, in an interview with the Washington Post, said that he believes there is a strong likelihood that Israel will strike Iran in April, May, or June of this year. So how do you explain these mixed signals? Is it on the one hand, the U.S. is sort of helpless? If Israel decides to strike, there's nothing they can do. Or two, are they using Israel as leverage on the Iranians?
Well, I think there are a lot of different strands of the policy which are, as best I can make out, relatively disconnected from one another. I mean, let's start with the sanctions that were announced today. I mean, in fact, I mean, the all Iranian government assets have been ordered by executive order, have been frozen in the United States since at least 1995. The only thing that's new about the executive order that was issued today is it explicitly names the Central Bank of Iran, which is something that previous executive orders have done. But, I mean, obviously the Central Bank is part of the Iranian governmental structure. And so if they did have any assets here, which I really can't imagine that they do at this point, you know, those would have been subject to an asset freeze long ago. I think this is more a kind of symbolic gesture to show Congress, to show Israel, to show others that the administration really is moving forward with implementing sanctions on the central bank. But in terms of substance, the regulations that are going to matter are the ones that still have to come out. Like, how are they going to determine if foreign governments, foreign companies, are actually moving to reduce their purchases of Iranian oil and their transactions with the central bank in ways that would permit the United States to issue waivers to those companies and countries? You know, that's where the diplomatic train wreck is likely to come. And on that, you know, the Obama administration has not yet issued its regulations, so we're still kind of on hold there. As far as the, you know, back and forth with the Israelis, you know, to the best of my understanding, the Israeli Prime Minister, the Israeli Defense Minister, you know, have both told their American counterparts, namely President Obama and Secretary Panetta, that Israel is not going to make a commitment to giving advance warning if it decides to attack. But then when General Dempsey was in Israel recently, my understanding was he received a briefing from the Mossad, where the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, says that, you know, they do not believe, like the American intelligence community doesn't believe, that Iran has taken a decision to move ahead with actually trying to fabricate nuclear weapons. And I interpreted that as the Mossad saying that when, you know, Israel gets around to making a decision about this, they are not going to be on board for a strike. So I think there's a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and signaling going on both sides. I think that the administration wants to try as, you know, as much as it can to distance itself if Israel does take a decision to strike, to basically say, you know, we've kind of indicated what our concerns are, but the Israelis did whatever it is they decide to do. I don't think in the end that's really going to get the administration very much if the Israelis decide to strike, but it does seem to be a tactic that the administration has decided to deploy. And of course, Obama is doing this in the middle of an election season when, from a political perspective, the last thing he wants is a kind of open, public, unpleasant disagreement with Netanyahu and his government.
Well, one could imagine that scenario. Surely Flint Leverett, the Republican candidates already are tripping over each other to be the first to bomb Iran. There'd be a hue and cry from the Republicans to help our closest friend and ally, Israel. It just, the very fact that we've been talking about this makes me wonder who the superpower is here in all of this.
Oh, yes. Well, there is the famous story that after Netanyahu became prime minister the first time back in 1996 when President Clinton was president, and Clinton had his first meeting in the Oval Office with Netanyahu, and Clinton is widely reported to have said after this meeting, who does he think he is? Just who's the superpower here? And, you know, well, the superpower is the one that acts like a superpower. And, you know, in too many cases where Israel is concerned, the United States doesn't really act on behalf of its own interest.
But usually though, for domestic political reasons, and they surely apply in this case, and I guess my cynical question to you, Flint Leverett, would be, given Netanyahu's clear preference for the Republicans who are his friends, apparently, you know, he has a disdain, at least that's my understanding, with Obama, and so at the very least he doesn't like him. Are we talking about the possibility of some election engineering, given how the Republican candidates are committing fratricide? To my mind, the best shot they would have of getting elected president this year would be if gasoline was at $6 or $7 a gallon.
That's exactly right. I have it on what I think is pretty good authority that Netanyahu and the people around him have thought that Obama was his re-election, that he was vulnerable to defeat for some time. I mean, even before it was in some ways fashionable to talk about his vulnerability here, they were very focused on the potential for political weakness, the potential for him to be a one-term president. And I think they have been looking for various ways to increase the chances of that. And as you say, from just the scenario you laid out, where there's a strike, gasoline prices spike, a lot of history would suggest that the incumbent president is going to get blamed for that, at least in terms of the political fallout, and that would work to the advantage of Obama's Republican opponent. I think it's probably likely that Netanyahu on his own wants to do this, that if it were just up to him, I think he would probably opt to do this. It's just, you know, Israel is in the end, it's a prime ministerial system. It's not a presidential system where, you know, the chief executive does have this kind of sole authority as commander in chief. The prime minister certainly has a lot of authority in Israel, but, you know, you have a strong and politically consequential defense minister. The army, the military itself, has a certain amount of autonomy in an area like this. And I think it would be, you know, it will be a political process. It will be an exercise. If Netanyahu really wants to do this, you know, he's going to have to work on lining up the various members of the security cabinet, the various institutions that matter, the military, the intelligence services, and so forth. And I'm not really sure he has, that he has all those ducks lined up at this point. I mean, if he's really determined, maybe he could get them there, but I don't think he has them there right now.
Again, I'm speaking with Flint Leverett, who served as Senior Director of Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council from 1992 to 2003. Well, then let's turn then to the other question, Flint Leverett, as to whether this situation with the U.S. and Israel is being used as leverage by the Obama administration. Arguably, it works both ways. Israel could be using the leverage to force the Obama administration to have tougher sanctions on Iran.
Yes.
And conversely, the Obama administration could be telling the Iranians, look, you know, if you don't deal with us, you're going to have to deal with Israel. Now, from the Iranian point of view, would they? I mean, I had an Iranian human rights official on the other day who said that this regime would actually welcome war. So, give us a sense of how they might play this or are playing this situation out.
Yeah, I think I'd have a different take than saying that the Iranian government, the Supreme Leader, that they want war. I think that they believe they are prepared for it, and that if it came, that they could deal with it effectively, that they would have security responses that would be meaningful, and they also would have a very important political response. I mean, if Israel were to strike Iran, I think a very, very large part of the international community would see this in the end as an unwarranted, unauthorized, illegal act of aggression by the state of Israel. And I think that the Iranians calculate that they could play this to their advantage. They can play it to their advantage on the Arab street, you know, at a time when Arab public opinion is mattering more than it probably ever has. The Iranians would have some very important cards to play there. They could play it with important international players like China, like Russia. And then the Iranians think that they have security responses as well. They have at least the potential, you know, through Hezbollah, through some of its other regional partners, they could probably put about half of the population of Israel, the population in northern Israel, they could put a large part of that population into shelters for several weeks, if not months, if they were determined to do it, and would basically oblige the Israeli military to reinvade Lebanon. And that did not go so well for Israel the last time.
Well, Flint Leverett, I'm afraid
Israel tried it.
I'm afraid we've barely gotten into the scenario, but I thank you so much. We've run out of time. I hope we can talk more about this.
And
I certainly hope it doesn't happen too.
Yes, we all hope that.
Again, I've been speaking with Flint Leverett, who is a professor of international affairs at Penn State University. He's served as the director of Middle East Affairs on the National Security Council from 1992 to 2003. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting, ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. An angel sung about the home of the brave, and this land here under the free, one time, one night.